serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old John Sussex, a Hall of Fame cowboy who will always prefer the saddle to an 8-foot by 8-foot raft in the Indian Ocean. He'd also prefer the driver's seat of General Douglas MacArthur's car. That's a seat he occupied several months later while running a motor pool in the Philippines. He had to deliver that car to MacArthur's driver. Of course, he never would have made it to that moment if he didn't survive on that raft for one unforgettable week as an 18-year-old during World War II. The Liberty ship SS Peter Sylvester was headed from California all the way to India, where the teenager was supposed to help lead a team of 317 mules through the Himalayas to resupply Merrill's marauders in Burma. Before they ever made it to Calcutta, the German submarine U-862, captained by Heinrich Timm, torpedoed the ship on February 6, 1945. You heard John Sussex describe his memories from that night. 33 Americans would die, but he became one of the 142 who survived. You're hearing a pretty consistent message from John that makes it clear he's never dwelled too heavily on, or at least not gotten too sentimental about, the 7 days that he spent floating on that raft. Having no idea, of course, what the future might hold, but we can ask a few more questions and let's see what he's willing to share with us. How hungry did you get?
I don't know. I never thought about it. When they picked us up, they gave us something to eat. I think my belly had shrunk my stomach because it didn't take very much to fill it up. I really don't know. I couldn't eat that much anyway.
How thirsty did you get?
We got to where we took that water. Not very much of it got down our throat. It just kind of disappeared into our mouth.
So did your mouth get dry and start swelling up on you?
Oh, yeah, it got dry, but nothing was swelling up that I can remember. That's been a long time ago. I can't remember all that stuff.
And what about, you said you had your whole uniform on and your boots on and all that. But what were the conditions like? Was it hot during the day?
It was hot, yeah. We had to protect ourselves from the sun. And it did cloud up and rain once, I remember.
That probably felt good.
I remember catching a swallow or two of water in a can that I had cut open. When it started raining, I opened one of them cans up with my knife. I had a knife in my belt. And it wasn't just a little knife. It was a big knife. And I cut that can open and I held it up and caught 2 or 3 swallows of water.
Well, obviously, I've never been through anything like this. I'm sure almost everybody, if not everybody listening, has never been through anything like this. But I have talked to a few other guys who've been in similar situations, including Louis Zamperini, who they made that movie about, Unbroken, where he was on a raft for 47 days and finally picked up by the Japanese and then tortured and all that. And he talked about some of the guys hallucinating. He talked about himself praying and promising God that if he ever got him out of that, you know, what he would do in return. Did you have any of those mental gymnastics? Did you take time and pray? Did you think about your family back home? Because that's a lot of time to pass, a whole week out there on a raft with nothing else to do.
I remember thanking God for keeping me alive, that's all.
You know, I've talked to some guys who were sunk on the Indianapolis, and of course the famous element to that story is the shark attack, and a lot of guys died in that fashion. Did you have any concerns about sharks? Were you looking out for them?
Didn't need to. They were swimming around our raft. They was there. We just didn't stick our feet out in the water or put our hands in it because of those sharks. They was around our raft. And so we just stayed on the raft and stayed out of the water all we could.
So the fins were circling you?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, those sharks.
You realize, for us, it sounds crazy when that's not a big deal to you. I mean, your life is at stake here, and those sharks can eat you, and they're right there. But didn't bother you.
Why should it? We were sitting on the raft. They was in the water. We didn't stick our hands or anything in the water, so, and they wasn't bothering us, but they was big sharks and swimming around our rafts and stuff.
How close would you say they were to the raft?
Just as close as they could get.
They ever bump your raft?
I don't remember anything like that.
But if you fell over, you're shark bait.
Yep.
Was that a lot of the 7 days where they were in the area, or is that just every once in a while?
That was just once in a while. They didn't just stay around all the time. They'd come and go.
Well, after 6 or 7 days, they probably thought you guys were so skinny you weren't good eating anyway, huh?
Probably. Yeah, I imagine.
Is there anything else that you remember about what I have to imagine was the longest week of your life. The things that happened, the things you saw, the things people might have said, or the thoughts that ran through your mind?
No, I don't remember anything. You know, we all just had to live with what had happened.
And he's been living with that for 73 years since the sinking of the SS Peter Sylvester on February 6, 1945. History records the Sylvester as the last ship sunk by a German submarine in the Indian Ocean in World War II. Among those oh so thankful that John survived are 8 great-grandchildren, 6 grandkids, and 2 sons. His older son, Tim, facilitated this visit in LaGrange. Let's get a little bit of his perspective. Well, do you remember the first time that you heard this story about what happened to your dad during the war?
Yeah, I remember. You know, he's told about it several times and stuff. So, yeah, there's some things that he's said and has not said. So,
did that blow your mind the first time you heard it?
Well, I was pretty young, so I didn't totally take it all in. But as years going on, yeah, I have. It was quite a feat.
So, Tim, have you ever imagined yourself in that position that your dad was in as a teenager with his ship sinking underneath him and floating in the water for 7 days?
No, I guess I hadn't thought about it that way on myself. So I was going to join the service, and then I ended up going to college and didn't make it.
What about this thought that if he doesn't survive that, you never would have been born?
I guess not.
Does that get to you at all, or are you like your dad, nothing bothers you?
Well, I just don't, I guess, think about some of that stuff that way. So I do my own thing.
And your dad didn't really want to tell me about his action toward the end of the war, after he spent that time in the hospital, after he recovered from the ordeal in the raft, for which he earned a Purple Heart, by the way. But your wife just handed me an account that he typed up a few years back, and I'm going to have to read some of that. Your dad saw action on the island of Moratay, on Corregidor, on Luzon. Anything he's told you about that that you want to share before I go back to him?
Well, you know, he's seen a lot of action, and tell him about digging his foxholes and being in there for a week or so at a time and never taking your boots off. He was a scout. Mm-hmm. He'd go out and scout in the dark and find where the enemies were and report and stuff. So it wasn't just California to the life raft back. He was over there quite a while.
Well, I know this may be a tough one to answer or to put it succinctly, but take all the time you need. What have you learned from your dad? What has his example or influence or impact on your life been?
Well, to be truthful and do it right and do a good day's work, and no, he's a good man.
Well, what more satisfying words can a father hear from a son? But I want to go back to the father while we still have some time. Tim tells me that once you actually got on land and got a gun in your hand, that you were a scout going out at night to figure out where the enemy is. That true?
Yeah.
That's not an easy job.
Well, it's just a job. You had to do it. Don't worry about it. Go do your job, and that's it.
I know you weren't scared out on the raft, but how about doing that in a dark jungle? Was that nerve-wracking?
Not really. You wouldn't have wanted to walk up behind me and tap me on the shoulder. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been safe. You know, we was trained to kill people. And we had hand-to-hand combat, so all it takes to kill somebody is just these.
Yeah, your hands. You're holding up your hands. And I don't know if you've ever asked yourself this question, but I'm interested to know, and maybe some of our listeners are. So if you had your choice of a foxhole in the jungle or a wooden raft on the ocean, which one you taking?
Neither one. I'd stay out here. You just leave that stuff behind you and go on.
Never got hit?
Nope.
How close you think they came?
Pretty close. When the bullet goes past you and it pops, that pop is the air coming in behind the bullet. So it might only be about 3 inches from you as it goes by. But a miss is a miss. So don't worry about it. If you didn't get hit, keep going. I never did get hit.
Have you been back to Washington, D.C., to the World War II Memorial since they built it?
Yes, I have. They flew a bunch of us back there one time.
Honor Flight Wyoming?
Yeah.
What did you think about when you were there at that memorial where they honor 406,000 Americans who didn't come home?
I never thought about it. I just looked things over, and it was interesting to see. And so It was an honor to be there and see all that stuff. Yeah.
And those, all those gold stars, that represents 406,000 lives. Some of those stars represent guys that were on your ship that didn't make it, and others, guys that were fighting with you in the jungles and didn't make it. Did you think about those guys when you were there?
Oh, yeah, but you can't think about all of them. You don't keep thinking about that stuff, and you don't keep, you put it on a shelf and leave it behind you. The guys that goes, gets a little dingy is the ones that keeps the, bringing it back and thinking about it all the time.
And clearly, we've heard that's how you feel. And perhaps putting it on that metaphorical shelf is what allowed you to live that life of the great American cowboy here in Wyoming. And with your permission here, I'm going to read something from that shelf, so to speak, something you wrote a few years ago so your family would know what happened. There are some details in here that are going to add to what you've already shared with us. You mentioned that it took you 28 days to get to Melbourne, Australia. You were there for a day and a half, got water and food, and headed back out. You mentioned that the mules, those 300-plus mules on the ship, their bellies would swell up, so we would take them out and exercise them on top of the number one hold, and then some down in the hold. The mules would get kind of cranky. I was checking the mules in the number one hold one night with a flashlight. We were in enemy waters, so I held my hand over the flashlight and let just a little light between my fingers. A mule grabbed me by the side of my left hip and picked me clear up off the deck, scared the heck out of me for a second. Then it made me mad. I beat on his head with my flashlight until he dropped me. That was entertaining. And you talk about heading out toward Calcutta, 10:30 at night, as you told us, a heck of an explosion, as you write, and you bounced around in that chute like a rubber ball, just like you said. A submarine had been following us, and they'd shot two torpedoes in the number two hold, one right after another. You mentioned Marvin Fraley. You say when Fraley and I got organized, we went over to the number one hold where the torpedoes hit. It was dark and a lot of noise. We went back to where the rafts were. There were two of them. I don't know who cut them loose. I asked Fraley how he got out of that hold, and he said that he climbed one of those steel beams. They told us to abandon ship, and everybody tried to go down the ladder at once. I told them to line up, and they did, and down they went. I guess that's where discipline comes in. Everyone got off the ship and on the raft. Then a sailor came up and needed help. Fraley, a cook named Frank Kolb, and another guy Kolb called Junior and I went back aboard. Fraley and I held the ropes to the rafts, and the other two went with the sailor on the bow up to the gun to help the sailor. I saw Fraley put something in his mouth, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm taking a chew. Do you want one? It's going to get wet." I said, "No." About a minute later, another torpedo hit in the number one hold on the other side of the ship from where we were standing. Hatch lids were flying everywhere, and water was coming down so hard you had to bend over to breathe. I think Fraley lost his chew about then. We had to jump off that time. I threw two blankets on the rafts the first time we got off. That gave us one for each raft. We got on the rafts again. The bow of the ship was going down. When it did, the back half of the ship came straight up in the air. The bow went down, and we floated right under the stern that was on end. When I looked up and saw that, I slid off of the raft and swam away. I thought the back end was going to fall on us. The ship broke in half, and the back end settled back down. I swam back to the raft. I was getting tired. And a mule swam by and gave me a push that helped me get back to the raft. You talk about how there were mules floating everywhere. There were things floating everywhere. The two rafts were tied together, but then you heard motors running. The submarine came out of the water about 100 feet from us. We all slid off of the raft, hoping they wouldn't see us. The submarine went on around. We heard shots and saw tracer bullets, and I guess she went on because we never saw it anymore. When it got so we could see the next morning, we could still see the back half of the ship still afloat. There were 17 of us on the two rafts. The rafts were wooden, 8x8, with airtight tanks around the outside. We could still see the back half of the ship on the horizon that evening. We floated for 5 days before we saw anything. We found out later that one boat went back to the ship and got water and wine out of the captain's quarters. They said they could hear the men in the engine room, but there was no way they could get them out. I heard that the back half of the ship floated for 2 or 3 days before it finally sunk. The men in the engine room went down with it. The lifeboat that went back got picked up in 2 days. That was the first that anybody knew we had been sunk. Then they started looking for the rest of us. It stayed cloudy most of the time that we were on the rafts. We had some pemmican and some canned water. We couldn't eat because it made us thirsty. We had a little container about as round as a 50-cent piece and about 5 inches long. We drank 2 of those a day. Well, it says it right here, there were sharks around us all the time. And you talk about catching that fish that eventually got away. After 5 days, we heard a plane, and we sent up a flare, and they came over us and dropped some supplies, but because of the sharks, we couldn't get to them. You left that part out before. The plane fired two shots when they left. 2 days later, a Coast Guard cutter came and picked us up. We'd been on the raft 7 days and seven nights. When we were picked up, they got a submarine alert. They didn't waste any time picking us off the rafts and sinking them. They put us in the galley and gave us some soup. I think after about two spoonfuls, we were full. They locked the hatch down, and from the galley, we could see a gun sticking out of a port in the side of the ship. We were going pretty fast and circling and dropping depth charges. I suppose that submarine had been keeping track of us all that time. It sure was hard to sit there when all of that was going on. They finally quit, and we headed out for Australia. And then it talks about recovering in Australia, eventually being deployed to fight on Morotai. You went to Corregidor and then on to Luzon. And you finished the war as a driver for a general named Boleyn. Boy, I'm sure glad that this came off the shelf and we had a chance to add some of those details to everything that you've shared with us today. Thank you so much, Mr. Sussex. Once a cowboy, always a cowboy. And he's got the photos from age 2 to almost 92 that'll prove that. You can check out some of those photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find more information about the sinking and the survivors of the SS Peter Sylvester, the very last ship sunk by a German submarine in the Indian Ocean during World War II. 33 men were killed, in addition to those 317 mules. But what a privilege today to get to know a little bit about one of the last remaining survivors out of 142 who made it through. And as this edition of Hometown Heroes rides off into the sunset, why don't we let the Sons of the San Joaquin give John Sussex a proper cowboy exit?
Cowboy! Great American cowboy! With a horse and a rope.
I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
With a horse and a rope and a gun, he takes.